Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hi, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome back to our Coastal Command Cold War series. After learning about the new Cold War era unfolding, we wanted to talk to the aircrew, the two key aircraft types. In this chapter, we talk to Ian Chisholm, an air electronics officer in charge of a team of five senior NCO air electronics operators. They all manned the radio, radar, and underwater acoustic systems, as well as the cannons. Ian had over 3,000 hours on various Shackleton types. Ian, welcome back to Extended.
Hello, Peter.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the last time we spoke, we talked about the Coastal Command and Maritime Air Association, which I'd like to come back to. But today is really about your career, and in particular, the good old Shackleton. But where did your RAF and flying career start?
Well, my RAF career started in 1958 when I joined the RAF as a radio apprentice at RAF Locking. And I did 3 years at Locking and passed out as a junior technician. But just before the end of my 3 years, I was picked up for aircrew training. There were a few of us who did quite well in the entry were sent forward for aircrew selection.
Yeah.
And because of my electronics background, I opted to become an air electronics officer. So I spent a year at RAF Topcliffe in Yorkshire doing basic training, flying on the Varsity trainer.
Okay, yeah.
And in those days, this was 1962, 63, most AEOs went to the V Force.
Yeah, of course.
In fact, there were 15 on our course, of which I think 11 went to the V Force. And those of us who wanted to do something a bit more interesting decided to try Coastal Command.
Okay.
So I went to the OCU at it was called MOTU in those days, Maritime Operational Training Unit at RAF Kinross, and we were did a 6 month course on what was the T4 Shackleton trainer, which was a modified Mark I Shackleton, and this was slightly different from those in service. At that time, there were Mark II and Mark III Shackletons actually in service in the RAF. The Mark III was a nose wheel undercarriage, and the Mark II and the T4s were tail draggers.
Yep.
The T4 had ASP 21 radar, but it was located in the nose, so it didn't have a full 360 degree arc as the Mark II and Mark III Shackletons did. They had the radar, the ASV radar in a coupler, which hydraulically operated coupler in the ventral position in the fuselage, which you could extend to search and attack positions. So I did a 6 month training course on the Shackleton, and as an electronics officer, I did all the disciplines. But the main things we did on the Shackleton, as on the air electronics side, was we manned the HF radios, the radar, the sonar, the sonic 1C sonic system, which was the system that monitored sonobuoys that were dropped in the water, and also a very basic electronic intercept equipment. There were on that at that time there were there was an AEO in charge of a team of five air electronics operators, and we all manned all the equipment. Whereas later on, when the Nimrod came into operation, they had what they call wet and dry operators. The wet operators on the Nimrod just looked after the sonar systems, the sonics, and the dry operators manned the radar communications and the electronic intercept equipment. But on the Shackleton, we did the lot.
Yeah. And Ian, just going back to your first few flights on the T4, as it was then, what was that experience like? Because from what I understand, it was a very noisy, shaky, uncomfortable experience. Yes. Did you feel like you'd made the wrong decision and should have gone to the V-Force then?
Not really, no, because it was a very interesting job. You had lots of different things to look after.
Yeah.
You know, you were manning one equipment for, say, an hour and then move on to something else. So it was a very varied thing. It was very noisy. I now wear hearing aids after 3,000 hours on Shackleton.
Wow!
But my first posting onto a squadron was at RAF Ballykelly 203 Squadron. We had three Mark II squadrons at Ballykelly at the time. In fact, at that time, Coastal Command was quite big. We had at RAF Kinloss, there was the MOTU plus 120 squadron, which had the more swept up Mark III Shackletons. Ballykelly had three squadrons of Mark II Shackletons. There were two Shackleton squadrons at St. Morgan. There was a squadron based in Gibraltar, one in Malta, and one in Aden, and one in Singapore. So it was quite extensive in those days.
Yeah. And Ian, the posting to 203 Squadron, that was Mark 2s, was it, that you were flying then?
203.
And that was the Mark 2, was it?
That was Mark 2, yes.
Yeah. So what can you just talk us through the stations that you looked after? You looked after five senior NCOs across those disciplines. Yeah. Can you just talk us through each of their stations? You know, you mentioned the radio, the radar and the acoustics. Can you just talk us through?
A radio operator would actually man the radio for the whole trip. And in those days, we used Morse as one of the primary communication, because when we flew out of, you know, over the Atlantic at low level, quite often you couldn't get through on the RT. Morse was the only way of communicating over long distances. So we all had to be trained to send and receive Morse at up to 25 words a minute. But we also had the RT, but the radio operator would man the radio for the whole trip. It wasn't seen as a good idea to change.
Right.
But the rest of us rotated through. You'd normally do about an hour on the radar. We also had the beams, beam lookout positions, both port and starboard beams. We also had the radar intercept equipment called Orange Harvest, and that the aerial for that looked like a big spark plug stuck on the top of the fuselage.
Right,
and it was a bit crude because you could either have a X band, the old X band, and you had to have a special head on for that, or if you decided that the primary target was in the old S band. That had to be changed on the top of the fuselage before the trip by the technician.
Right.
So we tended mainly to use X-band because submarine radars, not that we picked them up very often, were primarily in the X-band.
Right.
But we didn't get many intercepts. We also had a thing called Autolycus, which was a thing that was supposed to pick up the exhaust fumes from a snorting submarine, and we used to home in on that. But nine times out of ten, it turned out to be a trawler with a diesel engine.
Right. And
we just rotated through those positions. What we'd normally do if we're out on a patrol and you did pick up an interesting contact on the radar, because the ASV-21, although it was quite an oldish equipment, was quite good at picking up. You could pick up a submarine snort mast that sometimes, if the weather was reasonably calm, up to 15 miles. We also used the radar for navigation. You pick up land up to 80 to 100 miles away, and surface shipping, depending on the size of the ship, but typically 30 to 40 miles.
Yeah.
Now, the radar, as I explained, had it was mounted in a cupola under the fuselage. When we were transiting out to an area, we'd have it in the search one position, which was the highest up. It was the least drag, really, on the airframe. But you could still pick up land quite well on that. Then when we were searching, that would go to the search two position, which was a little bit lower down. And if you made a detection on what you thought might be a submarine, the radar operator it was hydraulically operated. The radar would go down to attack, which was quite a big extension and improved the range on the radar.
Yeah.
And we had a special homing technique where we'd home the pilots in onto the datum, and we would drop a flame float to mark the datum, which time the submarine had probably gone below the surface. So we would drop sonobuoys. Now, in the Shackleton days, we carried sonobuoys in the bomb bay because they were quite large. It was called the Mark 1C sonic system. And we typically drop a pattern of two, what we call passive buoys, at 3,000 yard spacing. And then in the center, we drop an active buoy, which pinged. And we picked up the submarine, hopefully, Now, the passive buoys would pick up the cavitation from the propellers of the submarine.
Right, okay, yeah. And
but it was very...
And Ian, sorry to interrupt you there, but I can't wait to ask this question till later. How often were you in contact with Soviet or other nation submarines on a normal sortie?
Very rarely that you would pick up. We'd pick them up on the surface. But that would be quite rare. Soviet submarines, I suppose, typically about once every five or six sorties we'd have a contact.
Right, okay.
And a typical sortie of the Atlantic would be 12 to 14 hours in a Shackleton.
Wow.
We spent quite a long time in transit, probably 2 or 3 hours just getting to the area that we were assigned to.
Yeah.
And then a few hours actually on task in the area. Sometimes we would use a tactic where we'd go on to radar silence and do an intermittent, you know, we'd switch the radar on, do a quick sweep, you know, in the hope of catching them on the surface or snorkeling. And that worked sometimes.
Right. And were you able to identify the type of submarine as well?
Yes, by and large. If we got a good sighting, yes, we could.
Yeah.
But not so much. I mean, we couldn't do it on the sonar, whereas only in the later times with the Nimrod, you could identify from what you picked up on the sonic system, because it was much more sophisticated then.
Yeah. And
but in the Shackleton, it was purely, yes, there's something there. can we pick it up and track it?
Wow. Okay. So 10 to 12 hours, pretty uncomfortable. Talk us through the internals of the Shackleton. We've all already understood how noisy, particularly I think it was the Mark II, wasn't it?
Yes. In the early days, it was very noisy. Later on, we had what was called a phase three modification where they improved the soundproofing quite a bit. And on the Mark III Shackleton, that increased the weight significantly in that we actually had two jet engines fitted to the Mark III.
That's right, yeah.
The Viper engines to assist the takeoff.
Okay. So how long were you at 203 Squadron?
I was there from 1963 to 66. And then I was posted to Malta on 38 Squadron. And that was interesting because at the time, Rhodesia had broken away from the Commonwealth. It was the days of Ian Smith.
Yeah.
And he had a big row with Harold Wilson, who was the Prime Minister at the time, and broke away. And we were sent out to a place called Majunga in Madagascar on a detachment, because our job there was to pick up oil tankers who were going into Beira. They decided to put an embargo on Rhodesia getting any oil from anywhere to try and bring them to try and force them to acquiesce to what the Wilson government wanted them to do. Anyway, we spent typically, I think, 2 or 3 months out in Madagascar flying patrols. We had some Royal Naval frigates patrolling just off Beira, which was the port that the tankers would go into.
Yeah.
So we'd pick any tankers up and report them to the naval frigates, who would then intercept them and prevent them going into Beira.
And Ian, were there any technical differences operating in warmer climates versus the rather chilly North Atlantic? Were there any challenges that were a bit different to the way you operated down in the in that part of the world?
Yes, I mean the aircraft would get very hot, especially if it was when it was parked on the dispersal. It got very warm inside. We would sometimes, if we were very lucky, get a cooler system, which would on a sort of blow a big sort of air conditioned hose into the aircraft while you were doing your sort of pre-takeoff or pre-dispersal checks. But obviously they had to pull that out when we started the engines, and it warmed up very quickly. But once you got airborne, it wasn't quite so bad, because we quite often leave the beam windows open to get a nice through draft. But that, of course, did increase the noise level.
Yeah, sure, sure. But what was it like for a relatively young man spending 2 or 3 months in Madagascar?
We quite enjoyed it, really. I mean, I was married at the time, so my wife was located in Malta while we were in Madagascar. So she didn't enjoy it quite as much. But actually, because when you were on a crew, I mean, the Shackleton crew at the time, we had two pilots, flight engineer, two navigators, an AO, and five air electronic operators. And we stuck together as a crew. You always flew with the same crew. So we developed quite a good sort of interaction. And when we were away on detachment, all the wives would get together and look after each other.
Yeah. Okay.
So that worked quite well.
And one of the questions I forgot to ask you when you were operating at 203 Squadron up in the North Atlantic, was the role predominantly submarine related, or were you also
No, we had other tasks.
Yeah.
We we certainly, when the Russian, the Soviet fleet, as it was in those days, they used to do a summer exercise and come around the North Cape, and we would detach to various bases in Norway and fly out of there, keeping an eye on their surface ships and find out, you know, what they were up to and take photographs. That's another thing that we did as air electronics operators. You were responsible for air-to-surface photography. We had handheld cameras in the aircraft, and we'd fly fairly close to anything we were interested in and take photographs, which were then taken, you know, sent back. Developed a base, and the intelligence people would have a very close look at them. And in fact, those detachments to Norway were very intensive. I remember we flew, I think, the longest flight I ever did in the Shackleton was from a Norway base at, I think it was Bodø in Norway, northern Norway. And we flew just over 16 hours.
Goodness me.
In those days, we didn't have any in-flight refueling, of course.
Yeah.
So that was, it was quite a long trip.
And
we were typically flying a trip every other day.
Right.
So it got quite
quite
intense.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is quite intensive, and with the noise challenges and the intensity of the job you were doing, what was crew fatigue like?
Yes, it used to get quite bad at times. Well, to say bad, you certainly got very tired. In fact, I do remember one occasion when we were flying out of Norway on these Russian monitoring exercises, we formated with a Shackleton that was on its way, a Mark III Shackleton that was on its way back to Kinloss, obviously come off task, and we formated and took photographs of them. We tried to raise them on the radio, got no response. We even tried the oldest lamp. I think the whole crew might have been asleep for a while, and they were on autopilot.
Blimey.
Yeah.
So, sorry, distracted us from the journey you were on. So, on your Malta assignment, you had the 2 or 3 months down in Madagascar. What was the rest of the role out of Malta like? What were the taskings that you had there?
Well, one of the tasks that the Shackleton always had was, of course, long-range search and rescue. And we were always we had a crew on 1 hour standby. That was on all the bases. In the UK bases, of course, they shared it out amongst the various squadrons. But in Malta and the other places where there was a single squadron, you would do a 1 hour standby about once a week on average to be on search and rescue standby. So you had to be able to get airborne within an hour if there was an incident. And we also, I was posted from the Malta squadron to Singapore, to 2FI squadron, where we had quite a big squadron. We it was double the normal size. And there we did a 2-week detachment to Gan in the Maldives, which was a staging post, because we had to do search and rescue for the transport aircraft that were staging through on the way out to Singapore.
Wow.
And there we were on permanent 1 hour standby.
Yeah.
So you weren't allowed to have a drink, an alcoholic drink at all.
I know, you could quite easily look at this list of Malta, Madagascar, the Maldives, Singapore, and think of holiday destinations, but it doesn't sound like there was much time for too much R&R.
Not really, no. Although occasionally when we were in Gan, in the Maldives, if there was nothing coming through the sector, we were stood down to a 6-hour standby, so you could go and have a swim and do various other activities. So it wasn't all bad.
No. Okay. What was the rollout in Singapore? What were you doing out of Singapore?
Yeah, the main reason the Singapore squadron was built up was because during the Indonesian confrontation, where the Indonesians were actually sending boats across at night to the to Malaysia, because it was the Sukarno regime had a big contretemps with the Malaysian government, and they were come across and try and plant bombs in the villages in Malaysia. In fact, I did a couple of detachments to Singapore when I was on 202 squadron at Ballykelly to help the squadron out. Yeah, and we used to fly patrols in the Malacca Straits. And that was the first time we fired guns in anger. The Shackleton was fitted with two 20mm Hispano cannons in the nose turret. And if we came across one of these high speed, they were really just sort of almost like dugouts with powerful motors on the back, and they would come across a few of them at night, try and sneak across at night. So we would illuminate. The Shackleton had an interesting illumination system. It didn't have a searchlight. We had what was called flares, which were pyrotechnics, which we launched from the launchers in the rear of the fuselage, and they lit up the sky quite well. And we also had even more powerful ones called photo flashes, which were very brilliant, and we could take night photographs when we fired those off. And that was quite a task for the air electronic operators as well, because the smell of cordite in the rear of the aircraft was quite strong.
Yeah.
So we'd light them up, and these boats, if they carried on, we'd fire a few rounds across the bows from the Hispano cannon, and they would turn around and go home.
Yeah, wow. And did you ever fire? Did you ever fire the cannons at all, Ian?
Yes. We all had a go.
What was it like? Yeah. What was the sensation of firing those things?
Oh, quite interesting. They would, unfortunately, we were using mainly wartime vintage ammunition, so they would tend to jam quite easily. So you only had to fire a short burst at a time, otherwise the guns would jam quite quickly. So you had to be rather careful. But yes, it was interesting. We used to practice, of course, dropping a flame float at sea and then firing at the flame float.
Yeah, okay. And I would imagine you'd have to have good coordination with the pilots as well, because obviously the direction of the aircraft was critical. So you know, crew training, crew familiarisation must have been really important.
Oh yes, we flew a lot of training sorties. In fact, for radar training, we used to have a buoy anchored at sea, which simulated a typical radar profile of a snorting submarine. So we do what we call radar homings to the buoy, conning the pilots on, and they would drop some practice bombs, you know, and then they would have an operator, one of the operators would be in the tail cone position and assess the accuracy of the drop. We also used to use the RAF launches, you know, the rescue launches, that they would tow a skid. So we'd do homings onto a moving target as well.
Right, okay. And in Singapore, when you were on 205 squadron, again, that was Mark II's?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay. So where did the journey...
I did the tour on Mark III's. After Singapore, I was posted to RAF Kinloss on 120 squadron, and they had the Mark III Phase III's, which were the all-singing, all-dancing version of the Shackleton, with the Viper engines, of course.
Yeah. And did you have to go through any particular transition training for that and familiarisation training?
Oh, no. Once you were Shackleton qualified, you could fly in the Mark II or the Mark III.
So
there wasn't a significant difference as far as the the actual equipment was concerned.
Right.
It was just the configuration. The pilots obviously had to have more of a training because of the difference between landing and taking off in a tail dragger as opposed to a nose wheel undercarriage.
Yeah.
And as far as the rear crew were concerned, there was no significant difference really.
Okay, that's interesting. But you said because of the weight difference, there was an impact on flight duration as well.
Yes, the Mark III with the Vipers didn't quite have the endurance. I'm not quite sure what it was. Probably about 12 to 13 hours maximum.
Yeah. Was it nice to know that, though, considering that you could have been out there for 15 or 16?
Yes. A typical flying sortie would be around 12 hours, either on a training sortie or an operational sortie. But, I mean, some of the training sorties were less than that. I mean, the typical sort of training sortie where you'd do radar homings to the buoy and that sort of thing, that would be typically about 6 hours.
Okay.
And it would usually end up with the pilots flying circuits and bumps at the end of it for about half an hour, just doing various configurations, doing asymmetric, you know, tether an engine and practice that sort of thing.
Yeah. And was there a big difference to the role that you undertook at Kinloss versus Ballachelly, or were they very similar, just
not
different
really,
areas?
Different areas, yeah.
Yeah. And by this time, you must have accrued quite a number of hours. Did you feel like it was time for a change, or were you still enjoying?
The Shackleton was getting towards the end of its useful life, I guess, although actually they did convert some of them into the airborne early warning role after we got rid of them. Yeah, it was very nice actually to convert. When I was on 120 at Kinloss, we did the conversion from the Shackleton to the Nimrod, the Mark One Nimrod, and that was a welcome relief because it was much more comfortable to fly in.
Yeah,
and of course you could get out to your area much more quickly in the Nimrod than in the Shackleton.
Yeah.
The sorties tended to be not so long. Although, of course, later on when we got the in-flight refueling system built onto the Nimrod, then you could fly much longer sorties. But that was done as a result of the Falklands War, of course.
Just coming back to the good old Shackleton then,
yeah.
It's got many nicknames. Did I see you mention it as something in a message?
The old grey lady.
Yeah.
Yes, the old grey lady was another one was the Growler.
Yeah.
In fact, the Shackleton Association have a magazine called the Growler.
It's a great name. It is a great name.
Other people would say it was 40,000 rivets flying in loose formation.
Yeah. I believe that's been quoted a few times. But you mentioned, you know, the sound and you know, you now have a little bit of trouble with your hearing. Yeah. Were there any other physical or other challenges operating? You know, those 15, 16-hour flights?
Not really, because we were quite young and pretty fit. I mean, you had to be fit to be aircrew anyway.
Yeah.
We managed quite well.
Yeah.
I do recall that after a long sortie, when you're driving home, your car sounded like a Rolls Royce. You couldn't hear a lot.
Yeah.
We put up with it pretty well on the whole, I think.
What was operating in Coastal Command like in those days? You know, where originally
we were very much the Cinderella of the Air Force, really.
Yeah.
A typical example was Well, I mentioned earlier that we did search and rescue standbys in Gan, and we were given accommodation in Gan, which was, if you were lucky, you had a fan in your room.
Yeah.
Whereas the transiting, the VC-10s and Britannia crews that staged through Gan, they would be given air-conditioned accommodation.
Wow.
However, we did look after ourselves pretty well on the, in that we've given very good in-flight rations. So on a long sortie, we ate quite well, really. We were given sufficient rations, you know, for to make ourselves meals, because we had a galley in the aircraft that, you know, had a hot water heater and a small sort of stove. And the especially in the northern climates, the favourite meal would be what we called Honker's stew, which was consisted of, you know, tinned beef and all sorts of other things. Each crew had its own recipe, but it was very nice to have a nice warm stew when you were on a long patrol over the Atlantic.
Honker's stew.
Honker's stew.
I'd not heard that one before, Ian. But I'm sure a good few hours in when you were hungry, it was something quite special. And were there any particular incidents that you recall that might be interesting just to relay on the Shackleton?
When I was one of the problems with the Griffon engine with the contra-rotating propellers was they had a translation unit, which one propeller would be going in one direction, they contra-rotated.
Yeah.
And sometimes that would break down, and if the pilots didn't catch it very quickly, you'd have what you call a runaway, where the engine would overspeed, and that would be quite dangerous. I remember, in fact, one of the first sorties I did on the T1s and T4s at Motu, I was sitting in the radio operator's position right next to one of the engines when this occurred, and it was quite hairy looking out to see this overspeeding engine. Fortunately, the pilots managed to get hold of it. But when I was on 205 Squadron, we had a very nasty incident where one of the crews that was on its way back from the 2 weeks at Gan, they had an overspeed, and they couldn't control it. And before I think one of the pistons came through this crankcase and caused a fire, and they crashed into the sea.
Oh dear!
And only three of the crew survived.
Oh dear! With something like that, would the other Shackletons on standby for search and rescue, were they then the command?
Oh yes, indeed, they were out there pretty quickly to because they managed to get a Mayday out before they crashed, because they were transiting at about 10,000 feet.
Yeah,
so they had a few minutes before they hit the water, but they were out of control by then, so the aircraft just broke up.
Oh,
it was interesting actually, because the flight engineer, who was normally on our crew, was on that aircraft. He'd done a swap with somebody, and he was one of the few survivors. And I visited him in hospital in Changi a few days later, and he told me what had happened to him. He apparently he managed to get out through the nose. The nose had actually broken off, and he just saw this light and swam because. You would normally have your May West to hand, so he must have managed to get it on.
Yeah.
And that kept him afloat. So he was picked up along with one of the passengers, who was an RAF guy, on his way back to Singapore for R&R. And one of the air electronics operators who happened to be down the back of the aircraft, and he managed to get out as well.
Wow.
But the rest of the crew were killed, unfortunately.
Very sad, very sad. And just back up to the North Atlantic, any interesting encounters with Soviet craft?
Yes, quite a lot. We took photographs of quite a few of the latest Soviet ships when we were on our sorties. You know, we and of course we get the Royal Navy to escort them as well. If they were getting anywhere near our waters, we'd cooperate with the Navy.
And was that sort of engagement exciting?
Yes, I mean it was interesting to find a new ship that you hadn't seen before and take lots of good photographs of it. And the other thing we used to keep an eye on, Soviets would have a electronic intelligence trawlers based typically near Faslane, where our nuclear boats were based. They would sit off there, so we would harass, well, not harass them, but we would fly by very often and make sure that they knew that we were watching them watching us, kind of thing, and take photographs of them.
Interesting stuff. Well, fascinating discussion, Ian. Can you just remind us how many hours you had on the Shackleton again?
Just over 3,000.
Wow, that's quite a considerable amount.
Yeah.
Wow, I can imagine why your hearing's gone. bless you.
Yeah.
And later you went on to serve with Nimrods as well.
On the Nimrod.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was that like in...
And I did 3,000 hours on Nimrods as well.
Wow. So let me take a few minutes just to get your comparators. I know, obviously, technology changes, but the Nimrod brought in a whole new range of technology to the anti-submarine warfare tasking. How was it for you? How was the Nimrod in comparison to the Shackleton?
Oh, it was a step change, really. Especially on the sonar side, we had much smaller sonar buoys, and we could carry a lot more of them. And we had a system called Jezebel, which was an American system, but we took them on board. In the early stages, it was fairly crude in that we just had pen recorders, but at least you could act because in the Shackleton we were never really able to pick up a Soviet nuclear submarines because they didn't broach the surface, so we could never pick them up. But with the Nimrod, you'd lay a pattern of sonar buoys and you'd pick the nuclear boats up as if they came through your pattern. So it was much easier to locate and track them in the Nimrod than in the Shackleton. In the Shackleton, you were really looking for diesel electric submarines that used the snorkel to broach the surface.
Interesting.
And the sonic system in the Shackleton was purely a final location aid. It wasn't a search facility.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have, because they were big and carried in the bomb bay, there was a limit to the numbers you could carry. And in any case, the range was very limited on those buoys. Whereas in the early days the buoys that were used on the Nimrod, you could pick up a submarine under the surface at up to 10 miles.
Wow. So, big difference.
A big pattern.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Ian, that's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing those stories on the old grey lady, the growler, and any other names that are out there. I've learned something about Honker Stew. But more importantly, Ian, you are the secretary of the Coastal Command and Maritime Air Association. Can you just remind us a little bit about what the association does, what it stands for, and how we can find out a little bit more about it?
It's just a way of keeping in contact with former colleagues, really. We have an annual get-together once a year in different parts of the country, typically attended by... I think the size of the association is diminishing now. I mean, I'm in my 80s now, and many of the others are, because the guys that are currently on squadrons, and not that there are many anyway now in the maritime, there's only a couple of maritime squadrons flying the P-8 Poseidon. But we keep in touch, and we have a newsletter which is published twice a year, which has, you know, various items of interest in it. So it's basically an old comrades association.
Okay. Where can people find out about the association if they're interested in maybe supporting it in some way?
We have a website. We have a website, yeah.
Okay.
If you Google CCMAA, you'll probably pick it up.
Okay, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Okay.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us today, overcoming some technical difficulties. We had a little bit of a delay in the signal, so apologies to our listeners for that. But it's been fascinating to hear your story.
Okay, Peter. Glad to help.
Thank you so much.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
We hope you enjoyed hearing Ian talk, and of course, we all now know what Honker Stew is. In our next chapter, we'll be hearing all about Shackleton that still growls. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music and the Aviation Historian for their support. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter X, and Extended can be found across all most social media portals. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, and thank you again for listening. Stay tuned to hear our next chapter of the Cold War Coastal Command story. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.